Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Well, good evening. I would like to welcome you to the Stop Child Abuse Now talk radio show sponsored by NASCA, which stands for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. And my name is Penelope Bennett, and I'm from Bellevue, Washington. I'm here with my co-host, Annie Margit. She's from California. We welcome you this evening. It is Tuesday, January 18th, 2021, and this is scan number 2837. And SCAN stands for Child Stop Child Abuse Now. So 2837, the show will be archived on the NASCA website, which is www.naasca.org. And tonight we have an open forum format type show where we discuss a topic that is related to something very relevant to adult survivors of child abuse. And tonight we will be discussing modalities that we've experienced or that we have heard of as recovering as survivors, adult survivors of child abuse. Before Annie and I start the show and open up the lines for anyone to call in and be a member of our panel, and no experience necessary, I wanted to give you that number. So to call in and be a participant in the show this evening, we would welcome you to do so. You just have to dial the following number. It is area code 646-595-2118. Again, that's area code 646-595-2118. And Annie, my co-host, will meet you on our back line and welcome you into the show. As I mentioned, no experience necessary, just curiosity and interest in learning a little bit more about what we stand for at NASCA, because as you know, NASCA is all about child abuse intervention, prevention, and recovery. Let's talk to you about NASCA's mission, because we have a single purpose at NASCA, and it's to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas and neglect. And we do so with only two goals. The first, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts, showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. The second, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. So once again, tonight is an open mic forum. We welcome anyone interested in learning more about child abuse, trauma prevention, intervention, recovery to call in. That number is area code 646-595-2118. So as we kick up the show, just a little bit more information about how the show works on an open forum night. So it is a call to survivors, so we are very well-versed and knowledgeable in all the issues relating to the topic, and we bring up these topics to expand upon them so that you, the listener, can contribute and learn. We offer a trauma-informed perspective, and we will help guide a discussion on the issues of child abuse, trauma, and healthy human sexuality that spring from questions and topics brought to us by our listeners. So please, if you're listening in and you've never called into the show before, but you're intrigued, this is the night to do it. So we encourage you to call in, again, area code 646-595-2118. On the line I have, as I mentioned, my co-host, Annie. And we have another caller calling in. And Annie, is it okay for me to announce the name of this caller?
Yes, because Monica is a volunteer co-host, and she has spoken with Carol and is here tonight.
Wonderful, wonderful. Monica, we've unmuted your mic, so I'd like to welcome you into the discussion with us this evening. So welcome, Monica.
Thank you so very much for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. And, you know, I really recognize that area code. And as I mentioned, I'm from Bellevue, Washington, and I have a feeling that you're not too far away from me.
I'm in Seattle, actually. I was actually a born and bred Southern girl and transplanted here to Washington State about 3.5 years ago now.
Got it. Well, so we are all, which is really unusual, all on the West Coast time right now. We're all on Pacific time. Normally, we have many of our NASCA members and our other hosts are on Eastern time, so or Central time. So we are the West Coast crew here. Well, it's nice to speak to a fellow Pacific Northwesterner, Monica. I've been up here.
Oh, thank you.
So, you're welcome. I've been up here in Bellevue for 24 years, so I'm a transplant as well. It's been a little bit longer for me.
Awesome.
So as Anya discussed before the show started, because this is an open mic forum, we bring up a topic. We discussed talking about, you know, different modalities that we've either used in our recovery and our journey to recovery and healing that we still use or that we've heard of. That we know to have helped other people. And a lot of these shows are just opportunities for us to have these open discussions and also to not only share our experiences but be resources. And we do love to hear from others because we learn a lot from other panel members and family members that call in. So the topic is healing modalities. And what I normally do as a host is I just, there's three of us on the line right now, and hopefully we'll be also having other additional callers call in. But I will facilitate the discussion, and I will prompt either you or Annie to join in the conversation if you wish.
Sure.
So that is the way that open mic work night. Excuse me, open mic night works. That's a mouthful. But it is organized in that fashion of at least there being a facilitator so that everybody has an equal opportunity to participate. So I'll just kick it off and start because I think part of actually a healing modality, well, healing and recognizing or initiating that journey is to really realize it. There's a need for it. And for me, I actually, you know, was living my trauma and carrying all this inside, some of it in the form of repressed memories, without ever having really even acknowledged, because I was living what I knew. I was living the trauma that I knew. So it was the urging of my primary care physician because my physician noticed that I had some adult manifestations that he had observed. And he had been treating me for 10 years. And they were becoming, I think as the burdens I was carrying were becoming heavier, they were becoming more apparent. And so he urged me to start cognitive behavioral therapy with a psychologist. But I would say that for me, the first step in actually healing, and I think, is to recognize information, some curiosity, some things that need to be addressed. So So for me, I was my adult manifestations of the child abuse were visible. The forms of I was hypervigilant. I was overfunctioning. I was in a state of fight or flight. I completely dissociated during physical abuse, and I was numb. I was just numb, and I was always in fight or flight mode. And I think that he noticed some of these. He did notice some of these behaviors, and that's when my healing journey began. Was I took him, I trusted him, and I went and started cognitive behavioral therapy. And so, as for all of you that are aware of it or may not be aware of it, that is obviously like the traditional. And I went. And I was very lucky that I was referred to by my doctor, a trauma-informed, trained psychologist. And I think that, you know, so the first one to make a couple comments and points was, I think, you know, healing cannot begin unless you realize that, you know, you have to get to that point. I think that where you realize that needs to begin. And then it was finding, for me, it was finding, I didn't realize how much trauma I was carrying because it was what I knew was my normal. So I was able to find someone that was trauma-informed, trained. And I have been consistently going in to do talk therapy. CBT is sometimes abbreviated as CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. It's been almost 6 years. So I just wanted to kick us off and just to make that point. So I wanted to invite Annie. I wanted to invite you into the conversation. And I don't know if the talk therapy has been a modality that has worked for you or how you initiated your recovery process.
Sure. The first thing I did when I retired on disability. I was extremely ill, and I'm fine now. But the first thing I did was call a therapist. I had never done any work on the child abuse in my past, and I felt like now was the time. And the first thing that therapist did was introduce me to an organization for people who were incested as children. And it was a 12-step organization, and I started going to that. So I was lucky, and then I found what I think is the greatest tool right away. I would go to face-to-face meetings and sit there with a small group of people who had the same experiences I had had. I didn't know other people had those experiences. I thought I was the only one, but I wasn't. And then listening to the stories of other people, I felt so much compassion for them that I was able to turn that on myself and start feeling compassion for me, too, and start feeling more anger at the perpetrator and less shame about myself. So that was my best tool, was talking with other survivors. And I know there are lots of places online to do that. There are Zoom meetings and there are telephone meetings and lots of things. I would recommend to find something like that to talk to other survivors of whatever you went through.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And I think that's such a huge point. You made some really great points, actually, in what you shared, because one thing I realized as well is that just speaking of these, bringing them out and speaking of them, right, bringing them out and saying it, right, and being able to, you were able to say it, be heard in a group of fellow incest survivors, but even speaking of it and just from what had been inside, because I think when we carry things, we also carry that shame and becomes heavy as well, but saying it, you know, being heard, and also, and as you mentioned, with people, for me, that's what NASCA brought, was I found a community of people that to really understand what I had been through, that had walked in very similar shoes, and there was an empathy and understanding. I found it very hard to describe what it felt like to be an adult survivor of child abuse and of sexual. And I felt that I had finally, there was something very, very healing, knowing that there were those that really, truly understood what I experienced on some level. So you had brought that up in the example you shared, and I do think that that was, that's a huge, for me, that was a huge step forward in just, you know, on my healing journey, was finding NAFTA. And it was a different kind of benefit, I think, than just going to talk therapy alone. I wanted to bring Monica in the conversation. Monica, I didn't know if you wanted to add your own experience or if you had any questions or comments about what's been shared so far.
Yes, and I'm going to make 2 points, both to you and then to Annie as well, because they resonate with me so far. And I will start by saying that my recovery, and I'll say my transition, started around simultaneously the same year that I was diagnosed with lupus, which has been about 18 years ago now. And to your point, as you said, that your primary physician began to point out certain behavioral issues and things of that nature, which we know now can affect our overall health. Those were some of the same things that were due to what now with someone with lupus that we call a flare-up. And my primary care physician pointed out stress, just really in a very angry place, you know, all of the time, just really kind of the world is getting on my nerves type of a place. And he really cautioned me with allowing that stress to go unmanaged. And in talking with him, he began to let me know that, you know, everything, we have your lupus, it's managed, it's under control, but regarding the other underlying things, everything can't be solved with a pill. I suggest you start speaking out or speaking up or even confronting the people that you say have hurt you. So through my journey of lupus, I found that it is tied directly to what we call ACEs. ACEs is an acronym for Advanced Childhood Experiences. And through the combination of physical abuse, sexual molestation, and the emotional and psychological toll of it all, my body, mind, and full spirit was under constant stress and threat of abuse. It wasn't daily. It wasn't always physical. It wasn't always sexual. It wasn't always psychological. But the culmination of those three factors throughout my childhood and my body in its most vulnerable stages, just the immune system never healed properly. That took me to a point of where, as Annie said, finding a group of people. I never really found a group of people. What I did find was a calling that led into my early teaching career. That group of people for me became my students, because I begin to hear, as you, and I've worked with adults primarily, so you begin to hear a lot of other factors that are driving forces for people that need to return to school, return to college, get a career, so forth and so on, and start a second career. And you begin to hear a lot of motivating factors. And the motivating factors I used to hear a commonality amongst people was moving away from abusive relationships or abusive situations, that they needed to go back to school to become independent, make more money, and get out on their own. So in sharing that, I began to grow more as a professional. And as a professional, you begin to, where you have to gain more training and really carve your niche out in your teaching style as an educator. And that led me along the path of students who are at risk. And at-risk factors could be a variety of things, but primarily students who are just not in a safe home or safe upbringing are at risk for a plethora of things, right? We can say poverty, drug abuse, gangs, but childhood abuse as we know now, yes, it is and has been a pandemic. I will say, as well as Annie brought out, that in her group of people, figuring out that she thought she was the only one, we all felt like that at some point, because that is the abuser's biggest tool, their biggest weapon, which is why the abuse sets in any form. It sets in and you're so vulnerable and you become targeted as a child because you don't have any other outside influences. And once that abuse has become normalized, then as you begin to grow and move out into your early adult life, it just became what it was. So you even seek out these toxic relationships because that's all you know. But the abusers, three things. They feed off of, and it's their weapons. I call it the three S's: silence, secrets, and shame. Once we know that we can move past those three things and begin to speak out, we begin to spill the secrets, we will eventually begin to strip away the shame, because these are all, again, the things that the abuser does in a very narcissistic view. They make the abuse about you. Right, and then you're that undeveloped, emotionally undeveloped mind in that space that you're in, they make you think the abuse is about you. So as adults, we either, two things, begin to involve ourselves in environments that are healthier. And I was really blessed because of that, not really seeking it out, but I was just blessed to be pushed along that road. Or unfortunately, you will become the abuser yourself, either abusing others or you will abuse yourselves. So what we've got to do is make sure that as we're supporting other adults, adults know we've got to strip away from the silence, we've got to unmask the secrets, and we've got to remove the shame. And as emphatically as I can put it to let anyone that's listening right now, abuse in any form is never okay, and it is never your fault. A lot of us are still carrying that, the dread of people finding out, even well into our adult years. And we have got to remove that in order to begin the road to healing. So in that regard, I'm here for anyone to address anything specifically that's happened to me, or specifically how I begin to really push myself into more self-healing, self-love, positive environments, and removing the negativity from my life. And ultimately, you will begin to recognize and understand abusive people, habits, behaviors, and others. And again, it's not about me healing anyone else. It's about me healing and loving myself enough to know that I will not allow any other negativity into my life ever again.
Oh, wow. And yes, I'm just been nodding my head the whole time you've been talking, Monica. Wow. Thank you. I love the three S's. And I've said all those things not together, but you just completely nailed it. I don't know if Annie, please, chime in, but I'm just sitting here nodding my head. And the first thing you said, and I couldn't agree more, and one of the first things I learned as I was starting to kind of unravel and understand, that I had carried all of these secrets and I had been so silent and I was literally buried in shame. It was just this huge, huge, massive burden I'd been carrying with me.
Mm-hmm.
What I learned and reading about it early on, of course, knowing that you have to do it and then doing it is a separate thing. But, healing from childhood abuse, healing from childhood sexual abuse is a total recovery of body, mind, and spirit. You have to, for me, it was essential to address all three because it's a full injury. And you so, eloquently stated that, in the beginning when you were discussing and sharing with us in your first couple sentences. And it is, for me, exactly the same, I have in sentiments, is that the talk therapy is one thing and getting it out is one thing, but that all the different things that, you know, you have to get to know yourself, right? You have to get to really connect with yourself to understand what is going on, because if our body, if our mind didn't remember, our body did. And you talked about your lupus. So sorry to hear that you went through that. And you've had those flares, but I understand, because just myself included, and I talked to so many other adult survivors of child abuse, we have, our bodies have, you know, kept the memory. And
yes.
We have, you know, we carry the pain. Our bodies, you know, manifest itself in our bodies. And I've had three spine surgeries. I've heard of other adult survivors that have autoimmune diseases, fibromyalgia, that you know, and then of course you mentioned too the self-love, right? Really learning to love yourself.
Right. If I could put this out there quickly, while you're on the subject, I would caution everyone to research, even though you're going to hear a lot of things about childhood abuse. We've got to understand what happens to the child as they grow up. We're still very much carrying, like you said, the memory of that child, of who we were. Like, your body carries the bumps, the bruises, the hits, the neglect, the bad words, the putting you down. That is rooted in the two things in the brain of where most people don't really like to go to when we're talking about things as mental health. And that is the amygdala. That will also be the hippocampus. The amygdala is responsible for our emotional selves. And it's actually the lowest part of the actual physical region of the brain. It's the first part of the brain that develops. The hippocampus is responsible for memory. Every other part of your body that moves and functions is affected by the brain. And so when these two areas have been so malnourished and mistreated, while the brain is still growing, at least up until about the age of 25, that most scientists will say it's growing and developing, the majority of those 25 years, let's just say at 12 or 13 years, the body, the brain, the mind has been abused. So if we don't put in any of the effort after we've gotten out of the house, gotten away from mom and dad, gotten away from the abusers, at that age of 25 is so critical that we still put in the work to acknowledging the abuse and begin to seek help and do it positively. Again, those were among my years and out of college that I began to teach. And as I'm teaching, I'm interacting with Karen worse and worse and worse stories with other individuals and thinking, I've been through this. I've gone through this. I've had this happen to me. And it made me be more compassionate and more open to be able to share my own stories with students and let them know there is a way out, but you have to be the way. Don't expect your abuser to be anything other than an abuser. So when we hear the stories in childhood, this is not about childhood. Childhood is where it starts. But as we're here with NACA, getting adults to understand your recovery, however old you are and whatever age it starts in, the recovery is what we're focused on now as adults, because we are going to have to really work and undo that many years and the things you remember as well as the things you don't remember or you've repressed. So for ACEs, anyone that may be dealing with these very weird, off the bat, out of nowhere type of illnesses, and for me it was lupus. Other than that, every doctor I've seen for the better part of 3 years trying to figure out what this thing was, they all told me that you don't look sick, until I just reached this one doctor that said, well, this is what I think it is, and we're going to send you through a battery of tests that lasted back then almost a year. And then we're back to his initial findings. Check out Dr. Nadine Burke. She is currently the Surgeon General for the state of California, and she has done extensive research on ACEs and childhood abuse and the outcomes of what happens with children as they then grow and become those adults. So for any of us that are dealing with any just really weird, abnormal physical ailments, we're not just talking about mental abuse because it shows up in the physical body. Take a look at ACEs and the studies that this doctor has done, and a lot of what you're going through medically will be directly linked and can be tied into what we experience and what we went through in our childhood regarding abuse and trauma. It started out as study initially, I believe, for childhood obesity. And as we begin to understand why people turn to food and use food as a coping mechanism, it began to unravel many more other type of circumstances that teenagers and young adults and older adults found themselves in, and how those illnesses left untreated, how the trauma in the body left untreated began to manifest itself even into our older years. So I just wanted to briefly put that out while you made that point. It's emphatic that we all get to the root cause of where the abuse was, how it started, and if it's still in our body, if we're not actively being as far as our recovery,
and
much more is going to show up.
Absolutely, it will. No, I think that I love the fact that you had quoted the ACEs study, and I wish that, you know, we could. The California Surgeon General, you know, Dr. Nadine, I think it was Burke? I can't remember her last name, but
Burke. B-U-R-K-E, Burke. Dr. Nadine Burke.
Yeah. She needs to be like the U.S. you know, Surgeon General. She's amazing, and her work is incredible.
Yeah.
In fact, we have
like
a family member that had done her doctorate work, and I believe. I don't know if it was under Dr. Burke or just had used her work, but her name is Skylia Ross. She's a NASA family member, and she did a lot, most of her doctorate on that. It was very, very fascinating. But the fact that, you know, there is an ACEs test that one can take online. You can access it. It doesn't cost any money. And I know it's like, what is it, if you score one or even one or two, I think you're at risk. Isn't that right, Monica?
Right.
Yeah. So... I remember
what
doing
that. She's working on right now is she's trying to develop it as a, I believe they're actually trying to get it in the medical terminology to where it becomes an actual diagnosis, right? So where it's not that, oh, well, you have lupus. As for me, they thought was some virus or something entered the body as anything else that we think causes a disease. It could just be what my body did, an overactive immune system due to years-long stress of where it never healed properly, and the body begins to attack itself. And outwardly, it can show up as many more things. So, yes, there's a test that they're looking for where you are with so many points on it. And, again, not a lot of it has been done for older adults yet. They still do the testing and researching children. But once the children grow and become adults, they're better able to have a prognosis or take a get the parents' help and do intervention-type work and prevention work to say that this will probably happen with this kid if they've had this many check marks regarding ACEs in their childhood. Mm-hmm. So right now it's being used as a preventative method in research, but they are really trying to put more effort into it to where child abuse, childhood alienation, or parental alienation become an actual diagnostic from a medical standpoint, so it then can be treated at that point.
And I love the point that you're making as well about earlier diagnosis, earlier intervention. And I think that's, you know, one of the things we talked about a lot. I know we've talked about that a lot in NASA is that, you know, we would love to stop child abuse altogether. I know that that won't happen overnight, but to intervene earlier, to have someone enter the healing process earlier, is a goal, and is to me it's so critical and crucial. The earlier we can begin, and the earlier we can identify them, the earlier that, you know, we can begin using those modalities that we're discussing to begin our healing journey. So I do want to bring on Katarina because I see we have Katarina who's joined us.
and I'm going to unmute from Mike. And Katarina, it's so nice to see you calling in. This is Melody. Welcome. Katarina, I've unmuted your line if you want to join in our conversation. And she might just be listening in. Or she may be on mute. Well, Katarina, I will leave your mic open. So you're welcome to join the conversation. And Annie, I just want to circle back to you. And I just wanted to see if you wanted to add to some of the points that Monica has brought up.
Yes, I couldn't address a couple of them, and thank you so much, Monica. You've been really helpful, and I've been taking notes. And I wanted to say regarding what happened to my health, I believe I caught the incest disease. That's what I call it, because so many survivors have it, and that's fibromyalgia. And it's unexplained. You know, they think it's all immune, and some people think it's neurological, and some people think it's nutritional. And, I've been suffering for it for 20 years, but it knocked me out. I had to quit working. But now I've been working on the issues for all those 20 years, and I'm well now. And I just want to give that out there to people who suffer from fibromyalgia, that there is hope. There is hope for relief of the pain. I'm proof of it. The other thing I wanted to say is that one of my main modalities of healing is writing. I write every morning 3 pages longhand with my fountain pen on a paper book, and I just write stream of consciousness, whatever comes to my mind. And it's a way to realize what's bothering me and to come to terms with it. So I didn't make this up. I got the idea of it from The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron. And she suggests doing this. But another thing I did was I wrote the story of what happened to me, but I fictionalized it and got revenge. And I think that was really good for me. So
when you write in the morning, Annie, do you just start writing whatever comes to mind? Put on the paper.
Sorry, good morning. and I, you know, I just say how I'm feeling and stuff like that, and then things come to me, problems come to me, and they just start spilling out, and answers too. It's
wonderful.
Like accessing a part of me that's quiet or something and letting it speak.
Mm-hmm. I've heard somewhere someone said it was famously quoted, and I probably am not quoting it exactly verbatim, but something doesn't become the truth and real until it's put in writing, until you put the pen to paper and you actually write it down. You ever heard that quote?
Mm-hmm.
There's something about, in, you know, getting back to, you know, the silence and the secrecy and the shame, that, you know, getting that truth out, right, breaking the silence, breaking the secrecy, but not only speaking, something about writing it, putting it in writing is another, I think, modality or method to just release it, right, from within. To really put that pen to paper. My mother always used to say, there's something in writing, it's there forever. And for me, I think the truth should be told and should resonate and be out there. So I think writing is a, you know, in that spirit, for those of us that have, you know, kept the secrecy and been silent, to be able to finally release the truth in a very profound way, for me, has been very freeing. You know, I felt a kind of freedom I had never felt before. So thank you, Annie, for sharing that about the writing. And I have one more question for you regarding writing. Have you ever written with your non-dominant hand?
I have, and I could tell different ages as I did it. Sometimes it would be really clear, and sometimes it would be like a kindergartner did it. And, yeah, I thought it was very interesting. I haven't been doing that, but I think I'll try that tomorrow morning.
Yeah, I was told when I first actually went to therapy for the first time to start writing in a journal and just put down, you know, whatever came to mind on paper. I had never journal written, but I was told in that first instruction, I really want to dig into my consciousness, deeper into the subconscious, to write with my non-dominant hand. There's something about writing with a non-dominant hand that taps a little deeper into your consciousness. So that might be for you where the different type of writing, whether it's bigger or smaller or more clear, I don't know. You said you could tell the age of your inner, you know, self that was speaking. For me, I could see when I wrote with my non-dominant hand, sometimes it would be really big and almost scraggly, and then it would be small, almost, you know, really big, like I really wanted to make a point. But I also have things would come up that was an out and on the paper that I had no idea where that came from, right? But it came out from somewhere. So I could tell that I was digging in a lot deeper, actually.
Could I throw in a point really quickly there in just some of the training and research that I've done in some of, as I worked early in career education and technology, and we were having to teach students sometimes to work with the non-dominant hand because the right and the left hand would sometimes have to work together to handle certain tools, machines, what have you. What happens when you focus on the non-dominant hand in handwriting, it doesn't look like your normal scribble. It doesn't look like what you're used to seeing. So what that non-dominant hand was, it wakes up an unconscious part of yourself that you normally don't speak to. So it looks, your handwriting actually looks like it's another person writing it. So when you're looking at it, you're going to focus whether it's bigger, small text. You're going to look at it and put more focus on it, the words that are actually on the page, because you're not looking at yourself. It actually looks as if it's the writing or the script of another person, whether it's messier or neater or what have you. But what that does is, being non-dominant, right or left-handed, it puts the emphasis on another part of yourself that within the body, within the mind, consciously or unconsciously, and it focuses in on that intention. So now I have to pay attention to the words and what I actually wrote, because this is not the normal self talking, i.e. the normal self writing, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. That does make sense. So it's a way to open up more.
Right. Again, digging deeper into the consciousness will be the dominant hand. You're used to doing that, used to seeing it. That mm-hmm. is a part mm-hmm. of the personality and your controlled behavior. The non-dominant hand is a part of the unconscious. If we can go into any movie or anything that we've ever seen where someone actually has a what we used to call a split personality, or now DID, dissociative mm-hmm. identity disorder. And once they split off into that other personality, it's not just another personality. They will speak a different language or speak in a different tone, or they write in a different hand clearly. But it's not the same as it is in the other dominant hand or the dominant personality. So we are aware of what we're doing writing in the non-dominant personality, but unconsciously it's just another part of the self that starts to reveal itself. So once you go back and reread that, now you have to force yourself to reread the non-dominant script, because it's not what you're used to writing. It becomes more significant.
That is fascinating. Thank you for expanding on that and explaining that. Wow. See, I'm giving myself some more non-dominant handwriting now. I'll tell you that.
I'm going to actually try and unmute Katarina's mic again and invite her in. Katarina, are you with us? This is Penelope. Are you with us? Katarina, you're unmuted at 604-373. Okay, well, I'll put her back. I'll keep her mic open for a few minutes. And Katarina, if you hear this and you want to join in, please feel free. So I'm curious, and I have a question now, you know, moving on to, you know, we've talked about some modalities and some, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, writing therapy. We talked about assessments. We talked about, you know, manifestations of the abuse that come out in the body physically. I'm curious as to, you know, any modalities that you may have explored or may have been successful in working with the spirit and working with the mind. And we talked a little bit about, you know, dissociative identity disorder or dissociation, about just the maybe therapies and modalities used to help reintegrate, and to, I think we're dysregulated to a certain extent, and bringing the mind, body, and spirit together as a way to integrate or regulate. So I'm very curious to know if you have used some different modalities to address that or that have helped. So, Annie, I just wanted to open it up to you and share, if you wish, anything that else that you had done in addressing that. And also wondering if you guys can hear me. Annie, can you hear me? Okay, Monica?
I'm here.
Okay. Well, I'm glad. For a minute, I was worried. Thinking, what happened?
For me, I would say that, again, there's been a very small window of when I did formal or traditional counseling. And again, this is along the journey of my spirit and body waking up with how I had been carrying so much of the effects of the abuse. I was in maybe in and around a year to 2 years after, so it's around the same time frame that I'd been diagnosed with lupus. I found myself yet again in another abusive relationship, which started out verbally and emotionally. It had been in a previous relationship a few years before that, so maybe only two serious relationships up until my late 20s, right? And the situation got bad enough to where there was a really huge physical fight between me and the ex-boyfriend, and we ended up being arrested, both of us, and we had to show up for domestic violence court. In domestic violence court, at the end of the day, the judge, as a part of the condition of our no-contact order with each other, was that we both had to attend anger management. It came out in court then that the ex was also a drug user. I was really unaware, other than casual drinking, maybe smoking pot, but heavy drug use like cocaine and I believe it was ecstasy, some other type of pills or things that he was in. But I was very adamant and vocal throughout the relationship that I just don't do drugs. I just can't tolerate it. I had seen it in my family members. So it was something that he hid from me up until the point that it couldn't be hid anymore. So through the anger management, I found a great organization in Birmingham and a great counselor. And it was only a short, like 6 weeks. It may be taking me eight to get it completed because I, you know, missed a few appointments. But through the six sessions, she really began to hammer and hit home that the relationship I found myself in was just another reflection of what I knew. Right. So I'd seen the abuse growing up at home towards my mom, towards me, other women in my family with abusive husbands or boyfriends. And in my head, I knew that I didn't tolerate it. So as long as it never got physical, I felt that I could fix the situation, right? We become the fixers and the people pleasers. Once it turned physical for me and the me in me that protects me, I fought that, which is why I ended up with in court along with this guy, because I struck him back in defense of myself. And so the counselor finally hammered home that, and I'm asking the questions now, this is a different guy, a whole different situation, but you just remind me so much of my ex-boyfriend from 5 years ago or 6 years ago, right? So as she began to explore what that situation was like, it ended on a terrible, bad physical fight, no, and that for me in my head, I'm out of here. If it ever turns physical, I'm out of here. The physical part of it is mostly the last resort. It starts verbally, it starts emotionally, it starts with neglect, alienation of a partner, what have you. I'd seen all of that again as a kid, but I normalized it. And she finally just really gave me the drop the mic moment when she said, you are trying to fix in your romantic relationship now what you want to fix in your father. So I believe it's a young Lavanzan. She would tell people a lot on the show that she had that guys marry their mothers and girls marry their fathers. Well, not in the literal sense, but in a sense of these are your first everything. Your mother is your first example of everything, womanhood. Your dad is your first example of everything regarding manhood. So the example that they showed you is the example of what you aspire to have for yourself. And for me, I didn't want the physical abuse of my dad, but the kid in me wanted it to stop, right? So these physical relationships that I got in were just a manifestation of me wanting to fix that bad relationship with my father. And at the end of that therapy, I'm going to tell you, that was the nail in the coffin for me that, hey, I will do whatever it is that I have to do, that I no longer put myself in another situation with another guy like this or a situation where I feel that I have to defend myself from whatever their problems are. And I have never, again, ever allowed myself to get into a situation where it's physically abusive, even to the point to where it's mildly we're having a disagreement and the voice gets elevated, you taking jabs, what I am out of there. It's just a threshold for me that is a deal breaker. Like, I just do not tolerate it. I don't engage in it. It's a no for me. I have not engaged in any other professional therapy since then, but it just pushed me a little bit further along on the things that I've been seeking and searching for, and then wanting to then advance my professional career. And what I began to look for more developmental tools or personality behavior development so I could better be of use in my classroom, it began to then seek out behaviors and what behaviors are rooted in and how they manifest itself. And through that amount of training, we undergo rigors and rigors and rigors of it. So I've actually been myself working in behavior therapy for just over a year now. And what that does for me, it continues to teach me to lead and teach and grow and be within the presence of myself always from a place of empathy and compassion.
Mm-hmm.
Once you're able to do that, yes, I can understand why abuse happens. It doesn't mean you have to tolerate abuse when people are being abused, but you have an understanding of why it happens, and then more importantly, why it hasn't stopped, but you also have to develop the tools to stop it. And again, it has to start with yourself. So yeah. If anyone else hasn't done, just let it happen naturally. I'm here to tell you that therapy is not some big bad wolf to be afraid of. We've got to remove the stigma from that. And just let it happen organically. Don't look at it as therapy. Call it life coaching. Call it life skill building. Call it whatever it is that you want to do. But you yourself, and it may be a short or long time. I took the short of it, but again, part of it is within my training now, so I'm faced with it almost daily. But once you begin to rebuild yourself, and you're literally, as you were saying earlier, you're transforming, you're transitioning. I look at it as being a carpenter rebuilding a house, or you're rehabbing a house. You have to knock everything out, gut everything, and rebuild it brick by brick. It can be a scary process because all we know maybe is the personality we've developed up until that point. But somewhere within us, that little boy or that little girl is screaming. They want out. They want help. They want to move on. So you're going to have to blow everything up that you thought you knew about yourself and the abuse and get on the other side of it by rebuilding yourself positively. And that's how you should view therapy. Let it get scary for a minute, but please know that on the other side is where you want to be, and you will eventually get there. And it's all positive, all light, all good people, such as NASCA, this organization, this phone call right here, right now. And there is hope literally at the end of the rainbow. It really is.
Absolutely. And, you know, one thing that you also mentioned that I have found also to be very, very, very significant to keeping me on track. You know, I'm on the journey, right? It's a journey. It's not a destination. But
exactly.
To teach, to be in a helping profession where you're utilizing the tools that, you know, you're teaching us what we're utilizing as healing survivors of child abuse, right? But to the same, to learn something is to study it, but to teach it is to master it. So I have felt, because I am, you know, teaching and helping profession myself, and that has helped me tremendously because you have to master it or continue to master it in order to teach it. And it's helped me grow. It's helped me to continue, you know, moving on in my own recovery. And so I think, you know, you're also, you know, in that profession, but I think it helps us with that continual evolution, right, and growth.
It's about turning pain into purpose for me. It's about turning pain into purpose. And that is something that I heard Oprah say. There's actually, I don't know if it's still available on YouTube, but it was a great panel that she did about maybe 3 months ago, maybe four now, and Dr. Nadine Burke was on that panel. But the show was called Sister Speak. I'm not sure if it's on the OWN network or if it's only on the OWN app, but you can find, like, segments and clips of it on YouTube. And it was about literally a panel of women, doctors, psychologists, teachers, so forth, and all of them speaking candidly and openly from their place of their own trauma, right? So it's nothing like healing if you don't know what the pain is. You know, you can't teach someone to be a great barber or a doctor or a lawyer if you've never been that yourself. Those people that are in those teaching positions were in the occupational position themselves. So that means your work as a healer, counselor, teacher, you have had to have been in that place of pain yourself in order to truly understand what it means to do the work to get on the other side of it. And as you were saying, being in a healthy profession, something else that can further along help you in your life is been the best blessing for me. Some people aren't able to do that, depends on what their profession is, which is why they will turn to books and radios and podcasts or movies or music or whatever. It helps them get through it. And with that being said, guys, again, we have to repurpose the pain. And I brought this up on the show I did a few weeks ago with Carol, and I want us to repurpose right now PTSD. Let's be realistic. Some of us will have some of this to some degree because of the trauma. You don't have to be a Vietnam vet. You don't have to have had a car accident, but trust me, post-traumatic stress disorder, any stress that you've gotten past that was traumatic, that's what PTSD means. I want us to repurpose PTSD and repurpose it as post-traumatic survivor's developing, because we are survivors, but we have to learn how to develop and grow and rebuild ourselves and our consciousness, our entire states of being in spite of that trauma. Guys, don't give your abusers the satisfaction of knowing that what they did to you and what they will never admit to now as adults, because that's a part of their weaponry, right, the silence of it. We have to never give them we don't need to give them any more of the stage, right? They've commanded the stage long enough. The loudest in the room sucked up all of the energy for the people that were just not exalting them or loving them in their own twisted way. Then you suffered at the hands of their abuse. The biggest weapon that we as survivors turn the tables on them. You silence your interactions with them. Remove these people from your life. You don't have to speak with them, talk with them, interact with them. If you haven't found a way to move beyond physical interaction with them, find a way now. But please, you're going to have to learn to develop a new sense of self and get past the trauma. Post-traumatic survivor's development is something that we should all ask, knowing, as you said, knowing that you have to do it and actually doing it are two different things. So we have to be physically capable and willing and actively doing something to rebuild these parts of ourselves that are still facing the trauma.
Absolutely. And not one size fits all. I mean, we all have to find ways that we can respond to that work for us. It's not the same for every person. And I think, like you said, it can be done. It's not easy. But I think we have to remember to be gentle with ourselves. I think that
yes.
concept was a new concept for me, that gentleness. You know, I was so used to beating myself up, right, to be perfect,
yeah.
to be this, to be that. So, you know, to be gentle with yourself and realize that it takes time, and it's okay that it takes time. You know, sometimes they're really small, tiny baby steps, but that's okay. And I think that's, you know, to just be gentle and not to put too much pressure on oneself. That's
yeah, and
that
be
was
patient
like
with
going
yourself.
To the new
be
world.
Patient with
yeah,
yourself. Be kind to yourself. These are the
yep.
things that the abuser set in, that kind of some of the sideline stuff that happened with the abuse. We can recall that punch, that hit, or rape, whatever it was. The sideline stuff that happens is part of us, again, the child in us, the kid in us, thinks that it's our fault, because that's what the abuser, you know, started to pour into us before the physical stuff started to happen. So be kind to yourself. I love the smell of my favorite coffee in the morning. I celebrate that. I may tweet about it. I may put it on Instagram, you know, with heart emojis, you know, going out to get a massage, taking myself to dinner. Whatever you can to begin to pour into yourself, self-love, self-care, I am such a big advocate of that. Every bit of that you're doing and just begin to make it a regular part of your daily being, that is the healing along the journey. The more positive you're introduced to and surround yourself with, the less of the negative that's there to remain, and less of a chance that the negative will begin to encroach itself upon your space. Be kind
mm-hmm.
to yourself. Be patient. Again, it's a journey. It's not the destination. Healing is a journey. We will forever be healing. We don't have to forever stay in a place of hurt. We can remember the hurt without the immediate stress or feeling going back to that place of the actual trauma or have it reacting in our bodies, right? So the healing is going to be lifelong, and just open up and embrace it again. However it happens organically, guys, just be ready to allow your world to be rocked. It's really and truly awesome. It's going to happen differently from everyone, but it's really and truly an awesome journey.
I can attest to that. It really, truly is. So I actually want to invite Annie back in, because, Annie, I haven't heard from you for a while. Are you still there?
I am. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you.
Hello. Oh, yes. I'm so glad. You know what? I had mute on, and I couldn't get it off on my telephone. So I'm sorry. I would like to add something. Another healing modality that I have discovered for myself is talking publicly with my name on it, first name and last name. Yes, Annie Margis is a survivor of incest. And I'm public about it because I don't have any shame. I didn't do anything. It's nothing for me to be ashamed of. And going public made a huge difference. I did it in 2014. I went public by publishing something with my real name on it. And it just made so much difference in my life. It really shed the shame for me. And I continue to talk publicly as I'm doing today. And I encourage other people too. Anonymity is very important in the survivor community and some of the groups. And I totally understand that because there's a lot of shame. That's why. Ready to see that it's not their shame, it's the perpetrator's shame, then they can start talking publicly with their names attached.
That's a wonderful, that's a wonderful point. No, thank you, Annie. Thank you for saying that because I think some people listening are obviously are in different stages of their healing process. Some are contemplating it. Some are been healing for a while. But I think to me the biggest step, what really I could say I crossed the threshold into healing and enjoyed it was the first time I was able to publicly say, here's what happened to me. And yes, I told my therapist, I had told some very, very, very close, dear friends, I told my husband, and that was wonderful. That was a great step in releasing that anonymity, like you said, shedding the shame. But the first time that I told my story on a public forum was on the NASCAR show, and as we all know, these shows are available to anybody to listen to in real time, to stream in real time, or to listen to the archive, so they're there. They're there forever, or they're there for a while, for anybody in the world to hear them. And it is a great platform for taking that step to say your truth publicly to the world. And when I did, on the NASCAR show, I was so scared because I was carrying that shame with me all the way up to the beginning of the show. I was shaking. And I thought to myself, I don't know why I'm doing this, but I'm doing this. And I don't know if I'm able to show my face to the world tomorrow. I mean, I was just terrified. I didn't know if I would be able to walk outside having disclosed this, the ugliest word, right? The ugliest truth, right, Annie? And I will tell you that after I finished the show, I had the biggest smile on my face. And I woke up the next morning, and any shame that I was afraid that I would be carrying with me was gone. Any trepidation I had about walking outside the front door was not there. For the first time, I felt like I could stand with my head held high and show my face without the shame. Someone that is just on the cusp and maybe, you know, a little reticent, but maybe ready to make that step, I say, you've heard it from Annie, I know you've heard it from Monica, you're hearing it from me. I was absolutely astonished by how I felt after going public. So it was the most liberating, I think, moment of my life. So thank you, Annie and Monica, for sharing that. I couldn't agree more. There is no words to describe that to you. That's finally released.
I think any way that we can find to allow that inner child to speak, it's going to be cathartic. Whether it was speaking out for the first time, speaking to a therapist, speaking to another friend, writing, journaling, all of that is very cathartic. And I would caution anyone right now who's not in a position where they can. Ultimately, for me, I know it's when I begin to have the conversations with my abusers. Getting past the anger and past the feeling, the sense of shame about that. I was angry for a long time, but I used my anger. I let my anger become a tool. Like, I'm putting gas in a car. I'm going 90 miles an hour to get to this situation as fast as I can. It still wasn't the healthiest thing because it just ended in a screaming match, but I was finally to a point that I could speak the words to these people. I began to channel that energy differently, and basically the conversation that I have with my abusers now is by being family. Unless it's a dire emergency for something that immediately concerns me, there's no conversation I will need to have with you as an abuser until your words to me will start with, I abuse you X, Y, and Z, and we will start from there. Because I'm not interested at all in any apologies. But my abusers know. Till you begin your own work and acknowledge the abuse of what you did to me, because I still deal with the fallout of that. I will have to deal with lupus for the rest of my life, right? So what I don't do is sweep things under the rug. I don't keep things in secret. I speak honestly. And abusers are still in a place of abuse. They don't grow. They don't evolve. They don't move past where they were when they abused you. So don't ever expect help to come from people that hurt you. So I'm more to the point to where I journal a lot, write essays. I want to be able to write a book and kind of pull everything together and write a book and put that out, because I can at least say more specifically in my own community, the African American community, it is very taboo to speak about abuse of any kind. It is very taboo to speak about therapy and things of that nature. Everything can't be found in your Bible, so I don't expect everything to be found in a church, right? And so it's just very taboo on what therapy is. Even though we need it, and it's one of the best ways out of trauma, is to just sit down and talk and be in a safe space to do that. So for people who aren't able to do it or not willing to do it or still not feeling in a safe space to do it, I hope I'm able to finally get a book compiled and written and get that out kind of like in a workbook form, because that's where I am in my teacher's headspace. So kind of in a workbook form to where people can actually use that as a self-help book, literally, not just reading on what to do, but a self-help book where they can actually do certain exercises and learn how to get on the other side of their trauma.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you. No, thank you. Absolutely. I mean, some great examples. Thank you for giving that own personal testimony. And especially the explanation of this would save somebody a lot of duress, I think. And it would have saved me a lot of duress if I had really listened to your words about don't expect your abusers to change. Right?
Right.
You know, it's when there are family members, because I think, you know, we are tribal by nature. And I think, you know, it's normal for us to belong to our familial tribe, our family of origin.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so hard to establish those boundaries for ourselves with those people that are our, you know, tribe, when we are healing and trying to build a healthier way of living and way of being treated and bounded for ourselves and standards. And so I think that is such good advice and insight as to, you know, you can change, maybe won't change and probably won't change. They can only change if they want to change. And a lot of times they won't and they don't. And you also mentioned the stigma of just being in a community. And you said the African-American community. I was raised in the Greek community. And very, very similar. I mean, we don't talk about those things. They are absolutely taboo. We never speak of those things. So I can understand, I can resonate with that. And when you, you know, so that I think is another layer of adding to keeping in those, you know, those toxic, shameful secrets, is also just the stigma that comes, you know, speaking with the forbidden truth, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So I really appreciate, you know, you sharing all that, Monica. I don't know what that is. Very bizarre. You don't hear that on my phone?
Maybe another phone ringing.
Yeah, although my phone is not, this is not, I don't know, I'm on my cell phone. It doesn't ring like that, so I don't know what's going on. That's very bizarre. I wonder if Katarina, I'm going to unmute Katarina's line just one more time to see if she has been able to join us. Katarina, I have unmuted your mic, squad. I don't know what happened. Her line is still on, but I don't know if she's currently not there. So we do appreciate her calling in. Maybe she's just listening in. I'll put her back on mute.
Is there any way that people can, because it may be a situation where people want to speak more discreetly, is there a way that people can maybe send a text or anything maybe the next time we have a call? Because if they're listening, they want to listen and take it in, but I have no doubt that people want to get a specific issue of their addressed. And if we can...
Well,
you put out some discreet way for them to send a text, call, and then we can address it discreetly for them.
Well, there's a couple things that people can do. So first is on the NASCO website, if you go under the NASCO website, which is www.nasca, which is NASCA.org, on the first, the homepage, there's a contact page. So there's a into a contact page. These are NASCA family members who are willing to speak with anyone who wants to talk to someone and ask questions. So these NASCA family members are on a contact list. Their contact information is there. Sometimes their email and their cell phone numbers are there. And so you can actually ask a question or have a conversation with anyone on the contact list, because that is what they have volunteered to do. So that's one way to get their questions out there. Another way is call into the show while we're live, like we are tonight, and opt to go in on listen-only mode. And what you can do is there's a way to raise your hand when you're just listening in. And the co-host on the back line, when the hands raised and have a conversation on the back line while the show is live that we can't hear on the show that's live, but you can have on the back line. And that way they can also communicate any question or comment they may have if they call into the show but don't want to, you know, come on live, if you will. So that's just one other way that I can think of that someone could, you know, be on the show, listen in real time, but not have to come on and speak if they're not, you know, wanting to do that. And that's their right. So those are just two ways that I can think of right now, the contact list as well as calling the show and just being on listen-only mode and then raising their hand and going on, having a conversation on the back line.
Right.
Now, also on all the social media platforms, as our and that's the family members. We also have in every state. So you can go on the NASCA website again, go under the ambassadors, under your state, contact your ambassador and communicate with them that way. And that's another way that you can at least, you know, make that connection. You know, I wish we had a chat. You know, if we were on Zoom, you know, we could have a chat, but we're not. We do have group recovery meetings 3 times a week through NASCA. They're separate from the shows, and Monica, I'm sure you're aware of them, but just for everybody listening, you go on, again, the NASCA website, which is nasca.org. You'll see that we have Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Sundays at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We do have group recovery meetings. They're open to anybody that wants to participate. You can go in and be anonymous, so you can not have your name. You can have your camera off. You can just listen in. You do not have to participate. It's not like we go from person to person during the recovery meeting and ask everybody to speak and say something. They are well facilitated, but you can participate if you want to. Otherwise, you can just listen in, and again, you can be anonymous. Anybody can come that wants to. There's obviously no cost, or health insurance required. It's just a meeting that's open to anyone that wants to participate. But that would be on Zoom, and I know on Zoom there's a way to post a question in the chat. That would be one way to get involved, to be in a discussion where we're discussing these topics, and to be in real time and be able to ask a question, but to be anonymous.
I will mention for those that are interested in joining the Zoom calls, you do have to register on the Zoom app or the website with an email address. So even if you don't want your email address and to get notifications or, the links about the meetings or whatever, because all of that's routed to your email address in order to sign in, because we may just be in a situation where we're not able to speak openly or we're not comfortable with speaking openly, depending on the social or family environment. So I would suggest also maybe getting you a anonymous, what the young people now call a ghost account, right? Just get a ghost email address. That email address is the only thing that you sign in and out of Zoom with if you're going to be on the call. So that way, no one else, if they have access to your phone, laptop, or whatever, that email address stays incognito. And so, therefore, any communications coming to that email address, they don't see it. And when you get on the Zoom call, you can get on the Zoom call with a fictitious name of your choosing, so that it will show the window. You can put up whatever type of avatar that you want. You don't have to open your camera or put up your own photo. Put up an avatar of a flower or whatever. But in the window, it will show a name. So choose an incognito name for yourself as well. So this is just about respecting your space and your privacy for those of us who are uncomfortable with speaking publicly, or we don't want that information to get out.
Hopefully that's, some ideas, some ways to get involved or to be able to listen in and maybe post questions in real time. As we all have different, levels of comfort and requirements for ourselves, which is obviously understandable. And there are a lot of different ways now with technology that we can do things, thankfully. COVID has brought that to us, without a doubt. We have about 5 minutes left, and I did want to add one more comment of my own, from my own experience about just being an adult survivor of child abuse and what has worked for me as a healing modality. And I have really benefited from the practice of yoga and meditation and mindfulness. And for me, I think yoga was for people that were super flexible, very fit, to do the splits, stay on their head, and I was very, very intimidated. I cannot do any of those things, and I am now a certified yoga instructor, so don't let that hold you back. But one of the things I did find is, and actually body work, as they call it, has been shown in some studies, in many, many studies, to be very, very beneficial for adults about child abuse. We talked about those that have been diagnosed or that are recovering from PTSD. But it helped me to reconnect with my body. I had been obviously in a state of fight or flight. I had disconnected from my body when I was very young due to the physical abuse
I was literally not even able to feel pain. My body was in pain. I knew I was, but I couldn't tell you where it was. I'd really disconnected. My brain had really disconnected from my body. So just the process of breathing, which helps regulate the nervous system, the autonomic nervous system, which helps tap into the parasympathetic nervous system, which really means that you just, instead of being in constant fight or flight and constant duress, it actually allows your body to rest, to reconnect, to reintegrate. And just through being able to breathe, being able to go into a very simple posture and be able to notice and to feel, bring my awareness to different parts of my body, I was able to reconnect my mind with my body. So body work is, as I mentioned, has been studied. If you want to know a little bit more about the benefits of practices like meditation or mindfulness, yoga or tai chi, there are a couple books. One is by Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, The Body Keeps the Score. Talks a lot about trauma and disconnected from the body and a lot of different modalities of healing and how the body work can help. Also, Dr. Gabor Mate has written a book. Dr. Peter Levine has written a book. I think Dr. Mate's is When the Body Says No. So just some references for everyone if you're interested in any of those types of modalities, the mindfulness, meditation, or the yoga. Also, Monica, as you were mentioning earlier, the areas of the brain that are affected in trauma, the amygdala and the hippocampus, those are also mentioned in the books. They actually do a really nice job of kind of painting the picture of what happens to the body, especially with those who've experienced like ACEs as children. So there's a few more mentions for reference for those of you that are listening. I wanted to share my own experience. I really enjoy the practice of mindfulness. It can only, take, I think Monica talked about self-care. It takes me between 2 and 5 minutes a day, even sometimes a minute if I don't have a lot of time, but I thought it to be extremely helpful. So that modality has really, really worked for me. But the self-care, I think a little deposits of self-care go a long way. So with that being said, I just really, really want to thank my co-host, Annie Marges. Annie, thank you so much. I think you're amazing. And I want to thank Monica.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're welcome. And Monica, it's with you. We're down to the last one. So nice to meet you. Nice to meet a fellow Seattleite.
I have no doubt that we have probably passed each other in I-5, 405 craziness and not even knew it. So, yeah, great to meet you.
Well, nice to meet you, too. And thank you for coming on tonight. We've had a great show. A lot of information. Yeah. A lot of
information. We did.
A lot of,
If I could put out there and to say that I spoke with Bill a few weeks ago when I came on the last show with Carol, and I have committed to co-hosting every third Tuesday of the month. So my next co-host date will be February. Let me find a calendar. That was in the February 15th. And again, Q&A. I log in periodically for the daily sessions, but every third Tuesday I will be co-hosting.
Well, I will look forward to co-hosting with you because Tuesdays are now my nights for a while, so I'm looking forward to that. I'm going to try and track you down on LinkedIn or Facebook. But we're down to 10 seconds, so I'm going to have to sign off with the show. But really, Monica and Annie, I just wish to thank you. Thank you so much, Katarina. Thank you for calling in, for all of you listening. Thank you so much for listening to the show. And as I always say as I sign off, there are enough adult eyes on this planet to keep every single child safe. It is our moral responsibility to do so. So if you see something, please say something. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Blog Talk Radio.